not what your country can do for you.
You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
Government is not the solution to our problem.
Constitute an axis of evil.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America.
Good morning, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for the very last day of 2012. All things political on the last day of the year, we like to do a little reminiscing, and we have a lot to talk about. It was a huge political year here in the state with the recall of Scott Walker, the election that made sure that he will continue to be governor of the state of Wisconsin, the re-election of President Barack Obama. And we're looking forward to the new year. There's a lot of news today, of course. Negotiations are continuing, the House and the Senate meeting today to try to avert the fiscal cliff. There is word, I don't know how accurate it is, that Democrats have offered to extend tax cuts, upping the number quite a bit for families making up to $450,000 a year, individuals $400,000 a year. We'll be talking about that. We'll be talking about the horrendous shootings of the past year, the Sikh temple here in Oak Creek, Wisconsin, and of course the horrors of Newtown. There is a lot of talk about whether or not there will be tough new assault weapons ban. Senator Feinstein will introduce that on Thursday of this week. So here we go. We have a lot to talk about. Our guests are James Causey. He's editorial writer and columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Hello, James. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
And Jeffrey Lord, contributing editor of the American Spectator and former Ronald Reagan White House political director. Jeffrey Lord, Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you, Kathleen.
Thank you both so much for being with us. Let's start with what's going on the Hill today. Are you hearing, Jeffrey, that there is a possibility that negotiations are fruitful this morning and that the Democrats are making a different kind of offer?
Well, when I turned off the set a few minutes ago, it sounded to me like they are still pedaling away there trying to get to this. One of the stories I saw this morning that I think is very interesting. There has been a lot of talk, of course, that if this doesn't happen, Republicans will get the blame. And somebody from the Washington Post went and did their homework here on the last election here and found that of the 234 Republicans elected to the House, only 15 sit in congressional districts that President Obama also won that day, which is to say, there's no real incentive. In other words, the incentive is the other way around for them. If they were to vote for a deal, they would conceivably, you know, bring about a primary challenge to themselves. The political threat to them does not come from the Democrats. So I think that that's an interesting thing to look at here as we see exactly what this deal is going to turn out to be, if it turns out to be.
And yet the polls are showing that the American people would blame the Republicans if there's no deal. Is that meaningless because their districts are Republican districts and people would go along with...
Right. In the districts, I mean, this reporter's point was, and again, this is the Washington Post, no you know, support of Republicans, as it were, there is more incentive for them not to do it than to do it because they would be responding to public opinion within their district, mm-hmm. as opposed to the national polls that say, you know, such and such percentage, you know, would blame Republicans. I mean, to them, it would be almost irrelevant.
James, what do you think? Do you think a deal will be reached today? Is it important that one be reached?
I actually think that they will extend the deadline somewhat. I think this would be something that goes until the new year. I really don't see them really coming to any kind of conclusion today. But that's just my own speculation. I just think if something was going to be done, it would have been done by now. I don't think you wait until, like, the last day of the year to get something done.
Mm-hmm. Jeffrey, if there isn't a deal, my understanding is that 2 million people in this country will lose unemployment benefits starting tomorrow, and every family, the average family, will see a loss of $20 a week in their paychecks.
Yeah, I mean, it can be quite drastic. And, you know, to be perfectly candid, this is typical of the way Congress operates. I mean, I used to work in the House and the Senate years ago, and there was nothing really different there either. They are always putting off unpleasant decisions to the last possible moment, and then they come up with some sort of, you know, last-minute fix to carry them over until they can take some more time and then come up with a last-minute fix again. So I have to say it's pretty exasperating, but I must say typical.
Mm-hmm. We'll go back to that, I'm sure, callers. And let me give you our phone number. I don't know if I did that or not. It's 800-486-8655 for your comments on the big political stories of 2012. One of them is happening today, of course, and what you look forward to in 2013. Endless elections in 2012. James, let's start with you and what happened in the state. The recall of Scott Walker, which was not effective. And then we had a presidential campaign that went on endlessly. Were there any surprises for you politically in the elections?
Yeah, for me, I was really surprised at how Walker won his recall with relative ease. I think what we saw, though, I think this state realized that the fervor from the recall was just dissipated. When it came time to go back to the polls, I think what we experienced here was just people were just tired of elections. We just, you know, we had so many elections in such a little bit of time. It just wore people out, and I just think a lot of that enthusiasm just sort of wore off. I assumed it would be a much closer race, but I think we learned a couple of things from this race. I think we learned that Milwaukee Mayor Tom Baird will be nothing more than a mayor in the city of Milwaukee. I don't think he has any, he could ever claim to be the governor. It's no way that he could be governor now after losing twice. And I think we saw that the state is still relatively divided. Even though Governor Walker won with relative ease in the recall, you know, the state still elected Barack Obama by a pretty decent margin.
How do you explain, that's the question that we kept asking, that we have Scott Walker as governor and elected him, as you said, handily in the recall, and yet President Obama won rather handily, and Tammy Baldwin won. What does that say about Wisconsin? And Jeffrey, I'll ask you the same question in a moment.
I guess it just it proves how divided we really are, for one thing. But it also shows more things that we should probably pay attention to. I don't think any party right now can just cater to its own. I think both Dems and Republicans have to do more to reach out. And I think that's the only way that we can fix some of the problems that we have now. I mean, that's part of the problem with this fiscal cliff. I think people have dug themselves into such deep trenches that if they feel that if they do come out, they'd be the target of a recall. So I think there has to be some middle ground from both sides. And at the same time, if someone stands out on their own, they shouldn't be prosecuted for it. They shouldn't risk being kicked out of office because they decided to do something bold. I mean, we want bold politicians. We want people to get things done. But if anybody steps outside their party and tries to negotiate something, they're looked at as an outsider, and they could lose their post. So, mm-hmm. You know, a lot of things need to change.
Jeffrey, do you think that Governor Walker is a future star nationally in the Republican Party?
Absolutely, I do. Absolutely, I do. You know, and I think the difference, and of course, I would be the one here that who's not from Wisconsin, but just as an outsider looking at it, it would seem to me that I think James was probably spot on there in terms of people being tired of elections. And they were two different, the national election and the recall were two different kinds of elections. Governor Walker had just been elected, as it were, and people were being asked to go through this all over again, and I think that factor was there at play in some issues that were, particular to the state of Wisconsin and his governorship. That's a whole different ball of wax than, you know, running for president of the United States as President Obama was running for re-election in the Tammy Baldwin Senate race, where the issues were different to a degree and, carried as senatorial and presidential elections do, different sort of reverberations here. And I think that it's not surprising that Governor Walker won and the other and President Obama won and Tammy Baldwin won under those circumstances.
We have a ton of phone calls coming in, so let's work some of those in right away. 800-486-8655 is our number. Willem and Colfax, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. I said the recall of that, you know, the recall process was instituted during the Progressive era, and it wasn't about the governor doing anything illegal or anything like that. It was simply instituted in a time of big power and money influence in our government as another tool for democracy, for the people to be able to recall the governor. And that's what happened. It wasn't an easy goal to get as many signatures as they did, and the numbers weren't moving on this process at all until they started to attack the process to sort of suggest that there was something subversive or wrong with the recall, that a lot of people didn't understand that it was part of our Constitution since the 30s. And so when they started to attack the process, a lot of people thought, well, if we recall them, there'll be these endless elections. And it wasn't so much a support of Governor Walker's policies as it was an indictment of the process. And the other thing about the Tammy Baldwin being elected and all that, and Governor Scott Walker, that happened because in a statewide election, the gerrymandering that they did doesn't have as much effect as it does on the local elections, where they redistricting under, you know, secret code, rigged the elections in this state.
James.
I disagree with the second part of your analysis. I think Tammy won because she did a better job on getting her message across. I think Tommy relied on the fact that he was a former governor of the state for years, and people should know who he is. And I don't think that young people had any idea who Tommy Thompson was. I think he had a hard time getting that message across. And for those who did remember Tommy, I mean, yeah, he was a good governor, but for some people, he was a guy that said stick it to him when Miller Park was forced on taxpayers. So I don't know if the second part of your analysis is right. I just really think Tammy did a better job on saying who she was, and Tommy relies so much on the past on who he was. That's why his message didn't come across as well. And he didn't have as much money either in the beginning. He was in a tough race in the primary. So it was tough for him to really get a financial foothold and get his message across, too.
Is this something that the Republicans did as well nationally, James and that, or Jeffrey, that they relied too much on the past and the electorate had changed? It was young people voted. Minority people voted. It gets to the question of the Republicans having to refashion themselves now because they were relying on past voting patterns, were they?
I think they were. I would say this. I mean, as somebody who worked for Ronald Reagan, you know, he won two landslides back to back, and they were landslides. And ever since then, with the exception of George H.W. Bush's first election, in which he was the sitting vice president for Reagan and ran on Reagan's coattails quite deliberately and successfully, other than that, from 1992 on, when he ran against Bill Clinton and lost, Republicans keep nominating quote-unquote moderate Republicans who sort of shimmy to the center, and then they lose, and then they come back, and then they go do it again, and then they go do it again. I do think that, you know, if there's a more principled stance, the assumption is that people vote a certain way because they're a certain color or because they're a certain age, et cetera. These are universal principles, and if you can, as Ronald Reagan did, explain them coherently and explicitly and attractively to people, they will respond, because certainly it was said of Ronald Reagan in the day, in 1980, that he was too extreme to win and he couldn't win an election and, you know, all of this kind of thing. President Ford, for one, went out and said that in March of 1980, as I recall. There was a big story in the New York Times, and he said he's just too extreme to win. So this argument sort of goes on, you know, is cyclical, and then, you know, eventually Republicans lose enough and begin to get the drift. So I think that, you know, times change, and I think Republicans were not onto this year, and they thought they could nominate Mitt Romney and sort of skate through, and it was a mistake.
Mm-hmm. Were you surprised by the results of the election, Jeffrey?
Yes,
you were.
Yes, I'll tell you why. I was not a Romney fan for some of the reasons we just touched on there. But I did think towards the end he was doing pretty well. I thought the Ryan pick was a good pick. But what did surprise me was the turnout on the other side. I think a lot of people, and myself, I would count myself among them, thought that the turnout for President Obama in 2008 was a one-time deal, and that the bloom, as they say, was sort of off the rose, and that kind of turnout was not going to be duplicated, and that was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
People really did come out. That said, I am still questioning how much of this is an Obama feature, and whether it's passable to, God bless her, I see this morning she's in the hospital, Hillary Clinton,
yes,
or Joe Biden or anybody else. I'm not sure that we've determined that yet.
Mm-hmm. James, why do you think some people were wrong about the number of people who would come out to vote for President Obama? Why did they?
I think, the analysis, they just underestimated the power of the people. I just want to go back once and say this. I think what it came down to was diversity of the parties. I was lucky enough to attend the Democratic National Convention, and I have to tell you, it was a melting pot. It was everybody there, every nationality, whites, blacks, Hispanics, you name it, gays, lesbians, transgendered, young and old. And it was just a big melting pot. I didn't get a chance to go to the Republican National Convention, but I watched it on television like most people did. Then when you looked out in the audience, what did you see? You saw mostly white people. And I think the Republican Party needs to, and I think they realize this now, they need to become more diverse. They need to explain what their party is about. And they also need to say, hey, to the young African-American man in college, hey, this party is for you because we believe in this. I think they have to do a better job of selling their message. They just can't rely on the fact that their message is just going to carry through, because I don't think it will.
Jeffrey, what should they do?
I would disagree to some extent there with James. I would say that I don't think that the Democratic Party is very diverse at all. I mean, in terms of skin color, and the Democratic Party has a sort of dicey record on skin color issues, going all the way back to slavery and segregation. I would suggest that just because people look differently, if they're all thinking the same thing, then there's not a lot of diversity there. I think on the Republican side, that attempt at diversity is certainly well underway. I mean, we have a Hispanic senator from Florida and Marco Rubio, and a new one in Texas and Ted Cruz, and a new African-American black senator, the only African-American, I believe, in the Senate at the moment. I could be wrong on that. Tim Scott from South Carolina. And we've had, of course, women leaders, Governor Palin and Michelle Bachmann, et cetera. And what happens is these folks step forward, and then, our Democratic friends say, oh, well, they don't really count, because they're really not fill in the blank. They're really not a woman. They're really not black, or they're really not a Hispanic. So it's sort of you're never going to be able to win that argument if you're a Republican.
I think it's easy to win that argument because it's so few that actually step forward. And that's what part of the problem is. You could say if you think the same that, it's not diverse. But the fact of the matter is, it's about visual perception as well. When you look, if you would have just did a comparison of who was in the audience at both parties, who was at the convention for both parties, it was pretty clear. And I think that message said a lot to the people of America. They just looked at them and said, maybe this is not the party for me.
When we had, as I recall, the speakers at the Republican convention were the first female black Secretary of State, Condi Rice, the first woman Hispanic governor, Susana Martinez, the second Republican Hispanic senator from Florida, et cetera. You can run through the list. These people certainly are there. It's just that the other side, I think, doesn't want to give them the shakes here because, a fair shake, because unless you agree, when broadening the base has come to mean, or broadening the tent, and however you want to put it, what it basically means is a Republican has to agree with a Democrat or a conservative with a liberal before they're, quote-unquote, legitimate. And that, I think, is where this diverges here.
You're listening to All Things Political for this last day of 2012. And our guests are James Causey, who's editorial writer and columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Jeffrey Lord, contributing editor of the American Spectator and former Ronald Reagan White House political director. Here's our phone number for you to join the conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. You can also use other methods of communication. You can go to talk@WPR.org or leave messages for us on our Facebook page on this last day of the year. What do you remember as the big stories and what do you anticipate we'll be working on as the new year approaches? Tomorrow, the new year. I'm Kathleen Dunn. More phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program on this last day of 2012, the articles editor of Popular Science magazine, and they write a fascinating story about the big science stories of 2012. Just to give you an inkling of what they're about, Hurricane Sandy, the FDA approving the first home HIV test, Google's self-driving cars, biofuel taking flight, the Arctic ice cap reaching new lows, heredity may not be limited to DNA, and the list goes on. It should be an interesting conversation after 10 this morning. It's All Things Political this hour, our last for 2012, and here is how you reach James Causey and Jeffrey Lord, 800-486-8655. Nate in Appleton. Hi, Nate.
The number one story is the extremism of the Republican Party. They are so far to the right, and policies that used to get them votes in the Reagan administration are repellent to many Americans. The number one problem with them is they're in the grip of fundamentalist conservatives. They're completely dependent on angry white folks.
Jeffrey, that one goes to you.
Well, I can only say that's not the Republican Party I know. If Ronald Reagan's policies were so repellent, he carried 44 states, including Wisconsin, I believe, the first time, and 49 states the second time. So I obviously don't think, and is ranked today as one of America's greatest presidents. So I really would have to say I disagree with all of this. I mean, this is a party that appeals on economic grounds, on national security grounds, and on social issues grounds. There's no question about that. But where this business of the anger and all this comes from, I confess I'm stumped because I don't see it. I don't know any angry Republicans.
What's happened to the Tea Party, Jeffrey?
Oh, I think they're still there. I think that they're. As the saying goes, was it Mark Twain, the reports of their death have been highly exaggerated here. I do think that they're holding a lot of sway here, particularly in the House, and I think that they will continue to hold some sway. You know, it's not unusual for any political movement that catches on, left or right, to have its moments of up and moments of down, and I think that the Tea Party will be there for, you know. And I listened to the term the Tea Party, and I think really basically what we're talking is economic conservatism here. And I think that the further along we go on these issues of the economy and the budget and spending, that more and more people, as more and more people are affected by it, the Tea Party is going to be fairly strong here, and the ideas behind it are going to be fairly strong.
Let's talk a little bit about guns. James, you've written extensively about this following the Newtown shooting and also the horrendous Sikh shooting in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. Dianne Feinstein, Senator, is going to be introducing a tough assault weapons ban on Thursday of this week. You have talked about the, in not glowing terms, the NRA coming up with armed officer in every school and suggest a gun tax. What do you think needs to be on the table, and do you have any hopes that there will be a lessening of gun violence in the next year?
Well, it's another shooting you left out of that, the spy shooting that
yes.
we had in Brookville as well. You know what? I always wondered why, you know, and let me be frank. I'm a gun owner. I own several guns, and I've written that in many columns. And I grew up around guns. I grew up on my grandparents' farm, and they had rifles in just about every bedroom and on the porch and everything like that. And it was like a way of life. You know, you use that for protection. You use that to protect your livestock and all those other things. But so I grew up around guns, and I understood them. And, you know, I owned my first gun. My grandfather bought me a rifle when I was like 8. So I've always been around them. But something changed here. Okay, when the NRA is a very powerful machine, and I think what they want people to believe is that, you know, this is about any kind of changes to gun laws can take guns out of your hands. That's not necessarily the case. I mean, there's no bills to take guns out of your people's hands, but I always wanted to know why do you need a magazine that fires like 40 to 80 to 100 rounds? Why does a civilian need that kind of firepower? And I said, if a civilian needs that kind of firepower, then they should probably change the profession that they're in. You know, a lot of people want to say, you know, I use my gun to go shoot cans and for target practice and all this other stuff. You know, that's a bunch of baloney. I think what it comes down to, honestly, is keeping guns out of the hands of people who are mentally ill and evil, and make it so that people who should not have guns, they feel that the law should be so strong that they would be better off not owning a gun as to holding on to a gun. I mean, when you look at what guns have done to urban communities across this country, especially in Milwaukee, you know, 70-80% of the homicide victims tend to be African American, and they 9 times out of 10 they're men, young men who die over silly stuff every day. You know, shootings over drug turf and silly arguments and things like that. And that's the kind of stuff that I worry about more so than, you know, a school shooting. The school shooting was it made us think about what's really going on, but, you know, I think about all these shootings that have taken place. We lose 10,000 people, more than 10,000 people to homicides, violent gun homicides every year. And now we're starting to talk about it. But we should have been talking about this years and years, decades ago.
Jeffrey, what kind of talk will we be having? What kind of legislation do you think we'll be seeing in 2013?
I hate to say this, but I should say preface by saying I am not a gun owner. But I really think that this is going to go down the same old tired roads that this conversation has been down, you know, for the last several decades. I don't really see any change here. The assault weapons ban that I think was in effect from that President Clinton passed and lasted 10 years from 1994 to 2004. Well, of course, in 1999 was Columbine, and it didn't do a thing to prevent what went on at Columbine. And I also noticed with some amusement, I was listening the other day to Soledad O'Brien on CNN getting into a sort of heated discussion with a guy by the name of John Lott, who has written a book on guns and gun control. And he's approached it not from the Second Amendment aspect of it, but just from the crimes aspect. And he says, you know, we're better off with more people having guns than less people because it and armed guards in different places, because otherwise, you know, the rate goes up. And he had all sorts of statistics. And she was appalled at this. Well, as it happens, I've been on CNN and I've been in that building. And, of course, Soledad O'Brien can't go through into that building without passing an armed guard who's there to protect her and everybody else in the building. So I find this a little amusing that you know, big media conglomerates, the New York Times, the Washington Post, have these armed guards sitting in their lobbies, but are saying, well, you know, we shouldn't let them in schools to protect kids. I think that if we're going to have the discussion, then we really should have the discussion. Senator Feinstein, for instance, is from California, and I suspect we're not going to be hearing from her about how the entertainment industry you know, affects people and this kind of thing. I mean, there's a whole long list of things other than guns that, if we're going to have the conversation, should be had. And I frankly am pessimistic that we're going to have it.
Let's go to Dan in Phelps. Hi, Dan.
Good morning. I would like to point out that 6 or 8 decades ago, hunters, gun owners, and sportsmen enacted a gun control law on themselves that makes it illegal on the entire North American continent, not just in the United States, but Canada and Mexico also. It's illegal to be in possession of a firearm that holds more than three shots while hunting waterfowl. Why do we provide ducks and geese with more protection than we provide our children? I will listen off the air.
Thank you for the call. James?
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. You know, this one comedian said once a long time ago during stand-up, he said, you know, let people have guns, but make bullets like $10,000 each, and that would protect innocent people from being killed. And I thought it's a little irony to that. You know, there's over 310 million guns in the United States. So when you say take more guns off the street, well, you know, that's not even going to take a fraction of any kind of guns off the street because there's just so many of them. I think laws only go so far. I mean, you can't. Bad people are still going to have guns, but what we need to do, we need to address the issues of like mental health. We need to address the issues of evil and make sure that people who are intent on doing bad to other people don't have guns. That they're so scared to own a gun that the penalties for owning a gun for them is so severe that they say no. I'm not going to do it. Yeah, they could find other means to hurt somebody. They could stab someone. They could do something like that. But you're not going to have the mass killing that you have right now. So I don't know. It's just one of those kind of things that, you know, until we address a lot of the problems in our communities with more mental health treatment facilities, more jobs for people with livable wages and things like that, we will never solve this problem.
Let's go back to what's going on today in both the House and the Senate and the American public response to their legislators. There is a good deal of concern, Jeffrey Lohr, that Republicans and Democrats just simply don't know how to cut any kinds of deals with each other. They're adhering to their own philosophies. The American public has set a pox on both your houses. What realistically do you think we can look forward to in 2013 in terms of compromise on jobs, on all kinds of issues, on taxes, on immigration, et cetera?
I have to say, I think there's going to be pretty much of a stalemate here. I mean, when you sort of step back and look at the results of the November election, basically we're where we were we're in the same place we were the day before the election, which is to say the Republicans control the House, the Democrats the Senate, and President Obama is in the White House. And however one interprets that, that people didn't want change or they liked the president, but various members, various Americans liked their own congressman. The effect of it is to set up a stalemate in Washington. And I think that what we're seeing with this fiscal cliff issue today is some semblance of what's going to go on for the next 2 years here. And, you know, it's interesting. We were talking about diversity and all this. One of the things that I think has perhaps backfired a bit, years ago, of course, we enacted a voting rights bill. And one of the sort of odd effects of it has been to encourage Republican districts and Democratic districts so that they're, quote-unquote, safe. And that means that if you're a liberal Democrat from, let's say, you know, Manhattan, you don't have to worry about Republican backlash for doing anything. You have to worry about the Democrats in your district if you compromise. If you're a Republican from a very Republican district, you have to worry about the Republicans in your district. And this goes back to what I was saying at the beginning. I just think that this is a recipe for stalemate here, and I'm not really sure how we're going to get around it.
Do you agree, James?
I really do. But my question is, can we afford another 2 years, 4 years of the same thing? I don't think we can. I mean, if we really want to move the economy forward, we really want to create a climate to create jobs, we can't keep doing things the same way. I mean, another 2 years of a stalemate or 4 years, I don't think our country can afford that. And I don't know, the American people don't have the tolerance for that. I think the public is going to force
politicians to do something, to act, because I mean, fiscal cliff. This would be the first sign to see if the public is going to step up to say do something, because they're going to feel it. You know, when unemployment benefits are cut, guess what? They're going to feel that right away. When taxes go up and you see that extra 20 or 30 bucks coming out of your paycheck, guess what? People are going to scream. They're going to holler, and they're going to call their politician. And they're going to say, look, you need to do something, or else. When it's your turn, when you're up for election, guess what? I'm going to remember this. And I think it's that fear that may cause politicians to act. That's what I'm hoping for. I just don't think we can afford another couple of years of the same thing.
Let's go to Maddie in Waupaca. Hi, Maddie.
Hi. Good morning.
Morning. Happy New Year.
Thank you. You too. I have a question. Some people say that this tax hike, payroll tax hike they're talking about, is a pain into the Social Security. And if that's the case, and Social Security is in trouble, how does that make any sense to not pay into Social Security? So could you clarify that, please?
Jeffrey, you want to start?
Sure. If you're asking, is Social Security in trouble? And I think I'm correct in understanding your question. The answer is yes, and also Medicare, I would add. So the real issue here is how do we fix those? And I think this gets to the problem, is because in fixing it, there is a perception by both Republicans and Democrats. They sort of do this very awkward dance with one another, that the first person who comes out and says, well, we have to cut this, or we have to change that, or we have to change the retirement age, or what have you, is asking for big political trouble. So therefore, they don't want to touch the issue. And I honestly don't know what the solution to that is going to be, until we get to a point here where we sort of not only go over the cliff as it is today, but we start to, you know, have some real consequences about Social Security checks can't be funded, can't be issued, that kind of thing. When those consequences hit, then I think there will be some action. But it's a mess, and to be perfectly candid, it's not being dealt with, you know, right this minute, and it should be.
Do you think that one is in more trouble than the other? Is Medicare in more trouble than Social Security?
Yeah, my opinion is that, as I read these trustee reports, is that Medicare is in more trouble than Social Security. I mean, they both have unfunded liabilities in the trillions. And, you know, we're already at the $16 trillion in debt that we hear about all the time. That doesn't count Social Security and Medicare. So if something is not done to fix this and do it fairly quickly, we are going to have a problem. There's no getting around it. And this goes back, I think, to the whole issue just in general. You look over American history, that politicians will have promised A, B, or C, but what happens is there are consequences of their actions and there's consequences of their inactions. And, you know, those consequences kick in and it changes the political dynamic incredibly. And I think that we're on the verge of seeing that here in sort of slow motion.
It seems, I don't know if this kicks in tomorrow or not, but a 27% decrease in doctors' reimbursements from Medicare, which could happen if we don't reach a deal here on our fiscal situation, is going to make a lot of doctors unhappy, James, don't you think?
Yeah, it will. I was curious about that, too. I don't know if it's something that kicks in like at the snap of a finger, or if it takes place over a period of time. I was a little confused on that. But, of course, you know, doctors are going to not like that one bit. But, you know, just like, you know, I won't like it, and most taxpayers won't like it if their paychecks they see a slight decrease in anything. So, yeah, it's going to be tough for everyone. But, you know, you mentioned something. You said that, you know, no one wants to be the first to come forward and say we got to raise the retirement age or whatever. How come they can't do this on a bipartisan basis? That's the part I don't understand. Yeah, it would be tough for one person to come out and say this is what we need to do, or a group of people from one party to say it. But how come it can't be done on a bipartisan basis with, you know, just a united front? I mean, that's what
that show true leadership?
Jeffrey?
Yes. Yeah, it absolutely would show true leadership, James. And that's why I'm skeptical it's not going to be done here, because I think there are too many people afraid of the consequences. What happens is that the history of Social Security, or for that matter, Medicare as a political issue, is that if you go out there and say, well, we should privatize it, or we should do something to save it, or we should do this, or we should do that, the opponent quickly jumps down your throat and says, you know, aha, you know, they want to, you know, throw the old people out in the snow, essentially. And then this becomes a very, you know, distasteful and dirty sometimes political issue. And that has created, I think it's safe to say, a climate of terror among politicians on Capitol Hill and of both parties here. I mean, the proverbial third rail here, if they touch it, their political career will die. And it is a problem, and there's a lot of mistrust there on both sides, and that's the real problem. And, you know, to talk for a second here about doctors, I had my good old 93-year-old mom in for her checkup just last month, and the doctor was, you know, apoplectic about the changes coming down. It's going to change his practice totally. It's already changed it. So I'm going to go back and sit down with the tape recorder and get the details here on how it goes, but I can assure you, He is not a happy camper as a practitioner of medicine about what lies ahead for him.
How's mom doing?
Mom is great. Mom is great. You know, we're 93 and we forget a little bit and all that, but we keep her active. We get her out there for Christmas. We do all the sort of normal things, but, you know, this is what we have to look forward to, I think.
Yeah.
Well, I'm 43 and I forget a lot, so.
Exactly. I'm with you, James.
More phone calls in a moment. It's All Things Political, of course, the last day of 2012, and it's been a year, hasn't it? It's been a year. So we're talking about all the events that took place politically and the ramifications for 2013 and beyond this hour of the show. Jeffrey Lord, contributing editor of the American Spectator, former Ronald Reagan White House political director, is one of our guests. James Causey, editorial writer and columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, is our other guest. And we have one line open if you'd like to grab it, 800-486-8655. Is our number. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're down to the last day to make your year-end gift to WPR, and when you make your gift, you'll have the good feeling of supporting the station that you love. You'll also have a tax deduction for 2012. Go to WPR.org and click donate, and thank you so much for all of your support in 2012. Let's go back to phone calls. Don in West Salem. Hi, Don.
Yes, good morning. I guess my question is a statement and question is, when somebody runs for a state-wide office or state-run office or just an in-state office, they have to be a citizen of the state. If, when it comes to voting, the people that vote have to be citizens of the state. Why is it then that we allow advertising from, like, the Koch brothers that seem to be putting in money for politicians from every state? It seems to me if you're going to put money in or back a candidate, it has to be from the state.
Jeffrey, you want to take that first?
Oh, gee. You know, what you're asking is, why is it that somebody from the outside is sending in money to fund people in another state? I mean, we all have that First Amendment right. This has gotten to be a fine art here over the years. It used to be that it was just done within states. Now in this day and age with all the internet, and frankly this began really with mailings, you know, long before there was an internet, mass mailings and all this, and people made tons of money with lists and all of this sort of thing. I don't think you're ever going to be able to stop this. If you're living here in Pennsylvania and you like Scott Walker and you've got the money, or you want to send him $5 or $5,000, whatever is permissible under state law, they're going to let you do it. I don't know how it's going to be stopped.
Do you see, James, any possibility of movement toward constitutional amendment concerning Citizens United, some movement to change the amount of money in politics, or not?
Yeah, I really don't see anything changing. You know what I would love to see, though? I would love to see, we should know where the money is coming from. I mean, I think that's every citizen's right to know, okay, this much money came from this state to fund this politician in my state. I want to know specifically who is behind this money, and I don't want that person hidden behind some kind of other organization. I want to know who's behind it and why. Well, what's their purpose behind it? It would be nice for us to know, and especially in the need-to-know basis, like most of us are. So we would like to know those things. It'd be interesting to know why someone in Pennsylvania, for instance, would care what goes on in our state. You know, I just want to know those things. And what's the payback to something like that? Because whenever you get large sums of money, there's always the possibility that, yeah, I got to pay this person back in some way, shape, or form. So it'd be nice to know if a politician in your state receives a lot of money, you need to know how much money what favors this person may have to pay in return.
Yeah. I still want somebody, maybe one of you knows somebody who's done a study on this, where all of this money goes for this huge amount that goes into political races. It's just
television.
It's all
TV. Yeah.
Who's getting
TV.
The money at the television stations?
The TV stations.
The TV stations make a lot of money on it. It boosts the budgets, like, even I believe.
What are they doing with it?
What do they do? Heavens, I couldn't begin to answer whether they raise the salaries of everybody that works at TV stations.
I don't think so.
Pay the anchormen and anchorwomen. I really don't know. That's a good question.
We'll do an investigation of that. I wonder about that. Let's go to Dan in Oshkosh. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how are you guys?
Happy New Year.
Same to you. James, I believe it was, you made a comment before on the electorate getting angry over this fiscal cliff. But I think the issue here is, if we do fall off the fiscal cliff, in 3 months we could fall into a recession. That would last for a year. Now we're 18 months after the election, 6 months prior to another election. And what we can spin this however we want. We're not going to remember what's happening now in 18 months. And whether we fall off or don't, these guys being elected are going to go, hey, look what we did. Look, now we're getting you out of the recession. Maybe a conspiracy theorist, but I'm thinking that's why we didn't do it right before the election, because we want people to forget what's happening now.
James.
You know, there's some political games being played, but at the same time, there are a lot of politicians who feel that, you know, they can't step outside their box. They have to stay within their party. They have to fight this fight to the end. And if that fight means going over the cliff, well, that's what we got to do, because I have to do what my party tells me to do. I mean, we don't have really true leaders out there who are really making the tough decisions. And just like the guest has said or stated, I mean, I think there's too many people out there who are just like following the status quo and doing what they're supposed to, what they believe that their party wants them to do, and they're not doing what the people want them to do. And, you know, until that changes, not much will change. And, you know, a recession, can we really afford another recession? No. You know, I'm looking at myself and I'm thinking how many cutbacks I've made in my life. You know, I need a new car, you know, but I can't afford one. So I know that. So I'm like, I got to make do with what I have. And my car is like 12, 13 years old. So it's just like, little things that could really boost the economy. If I have more confidence that things will get better, I'll probably go out and make that used car purchase and, you know, get a better used car. But you know, I'm uncertain myself. You know, I have a daughter in school.
You know, she's getting bigger. She needs more things. You know, I need a new car. My job is a little, you know, you never know what's going to happen. I mean, it's a scary time for a lot of people. And, you know, I don't know what to do. And I think a lot of people are in the same situation.
Yeah. Well, here's to a good new year for you, James, and to you, Jeffrey. Thank you both
thank
so
you
much for
Kathleen.
Being with us on this day. It was a good conversation. Thank you, James.
Thank you.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Jeffrey. Thank you. We'll talk to both of you
okay.
again
bye-bye.
In 2013, which is coming up tomorrow, isn't it? Something I still think it's 95 or something. Thanks to Brett Jaspers and Rhonda Fanning for producing this program. More ahead. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.
Live music, laughs, and a few surprises.
For four hands, one piano, two pianists, and watching your 10 fingers is a little bit like watching the chorus line at Radio City Music Hall. Lots of lively steps there.
We're committed to bringing you the best music and entertainment from around Wisconsin and around the world.